From Music City, Nashville, Tennessee, two guys fumbling their way through the music business so you don't have to. Here they are, it's Scott and it's Hino and the Music Row Show.
How about that?
How about that?
How about that? Hello, friends. Welcome to the Music Row Show. My name is Scott.
And my name is Hino. Thanks so much for tuning in. As you guys maybe have figured out by now, this show is for all you songwriters and musicians and, you know, just anybody trying to figure stuff out here in Music City about how things work.
That's right. We don't know anything. 10 years into this, we're still
bumping into walls.
Yeah, just, but we are out slinging songs during the day, just like you. But with this show, we're able to bring brilliant, talented people in, bring them into the studio, pick their brains, and give you the opportunity to get involved as well.
That is true. And you can do that by going to facebook.com/TheMusicRowShow. Chime in with your questions and comments there. You can also hit us up on Twitter at The Music Row Show. And if you just feel like emailing, it's mail@TheMusicRowShow. So lots of ways to reach at the show tonight.
I'm on the Facebooks right now. Matter of fact, Molly Jean has already
she already
popped in. No, just now.
Yeah, I see that.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah, no, you, come on. You didn't know that. Okay, maybe you did. Maybe you did. Hey, this is one of those nights we should really charge for in exchange for college credit.
I know.
We have some serious...
Especially the interns.
Right. We have some serious hit-making clout with this tonight. Very exciting.
Yes, that's right. We got mega hit producer and publisher Frank Liddell is here in the first hour.
And then we're bringing in mega hit songwriter and now publisher Liz Rose in hour two.
That is amazing. All right, Scott, well, let's not waste any more time. Let's get to it and introduce this guy here.
Okay, now this is going to sound weird, so just don't say anything for a minute, okay?
Okay.
This man has made my wife so happy so many times right here with the four Miranda Lambert CDs he's produced, three of them ACM Albums of the Year Award winners that have never left Jennifer's CD player ever. She just loves them. So thank you for that, for starters.
Well, I think you're looking at old bio because there's five of them, and we just finished the sixth one.
Don't.
That's okay.
Okay. But well, anyways.
So are you saying that Jennifer doesn't have those?
No, she does.
Okay.
She does. Yeah. She does. But... Just terrific albums. And then you add Leanne Womack, Marty Stewart, Jack Ingram, Bo Bison, scores of others he's produced. And one would think that's just an incredible career.
Yeah, done, right?
Yeah, no. He also has to become a hit publisher with Carnival Music as well, with so many hits recorded by Kenny Chesney, Billy Currington, Dixie Chicks, Tim McGraw. Okay, everybody. We have so much to discuss. Let's just get down to business. It's such an honor, and we're really happy to say, Frank Liddell, we're glad you're here, and welcome to the Music Row Show.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here, and I actually didn't realize that I was coming here to teach. I thought I was coming here to learn. So.
Well, boy, you would want your money back if that was the case.
So I understand that you started out your career wanting to be a banker, right? So how did that detour happen?
In retrospect, that's, you know, kind of the way I tell it. I was going down that road. I was a finance major, and I lived in Houston, and I went to a wedding in Fort Worth one weekend with my dad, just randomly. He said, come up to Fort Worth to this wedding with me. And I saw this guy named Brownlee Ferguson, and who had lived down the street from me when I was a kid. He was 10 years older than me, and I hadn't seen him since I was about 8, but I loved their family. I thought they were really cool people. And I saw him, I went up and talked to him, and I said, what are you doing now? And he said, well, I started a music publishing company. And I said, I want to come work for you. And that is exactly what happened.
That's it, just like that.
Yes.
had you already graduated?
Yes.
Okay.
But then, and so so he said, well, come to my office Monday morning. I was like, what time? You know, 8? You know, he said, no, how about, I didn't get it, you know. And he said, how about 9:30 or 10? So I show up at his office pretty early. And I think I just, you know, I had gone to University of Texas. I'd gone back to Houston, and my family was there. And all I wanted to do was put on a suit and come home from work and go by and see my dad and have a suit on, you know. So I dressed up my suit, and I went over and saw Brownlee, and we talked for a while. He interviewed me, and he said, man, I'd love for you to come work for me, but two problems. And I said, what are they? And he said, well, I can't pay you. And I was like, well, I'm cool with that. you know, and he said, lose the suit. And I was like, damn, you know. So anyway, I lost the suit.
Yeah.
And that was it. I started working. He had a little record company.
This was here, though, not
this
in Texas?
This was in Houston.
Okay.
He didn't hire you to be like a negotiator, did he? Because to say, I can't pay you, and you're like, okie dokie then. No problem.
I was cool with it. I was cool. Well, I'm probably exaggerating that story a little bit. He paid me some. But,
okay.
But it was fun. And originally, I started collecting money for him, and he had started a little record company. I helped start the record company, and I got some distribution in place, and toured around with this band and tried to get them, you know, sell their records. And we did all right for, you know, for local and regional. And he had, his first writer, and it's interesting, it's a long story, so I won't go too far into it, but his first big writer was a guy named David Lynn Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And David Lynn Jones had a song, Living in the Promised Land. He was an amazing writer, but he'd had a big hit with Willie Nelson. So Brownlee owned a Nashville office, and he hired a really great guy and a really cool guy, a musician, a drummer, to run his Nashville office. And he was there for about a year and went on to another company. And I was like, give me that job. I'll take that job. And at this point in time, you know, the lack of pay and all that, I felt like he owed it to me. But I look back and I know that I'm dead wrong about that. But ultimately, he came in and he said, you can have the job if you can leave on Monday. And that was a Friday. And I said, I'm leaving on Monday. And
wow.
And I was going to come here for 2 years. And that was 26 years ago.
Man. And what was the name of the publishing company?
Bluewater Music.
Okay.
Al Anderson, Kim Ritchie, Jim Lauderdale.
Oh, wow.
Jim Lauderdale is a human being, and as a writer, kind of took me under his wing, and a girl named Sandy Knox. A lot of those people were just really good to me, and Brownlee, of course, and a girl named Pat McMurray. We had a really cool team over there, and we're doing a lot of fun things.
I think every single one of those have been on the show.
Pretty much.
Really. Yeah.
Not Brownlee.
No. But Lauderdale.
Yep.
Sandy. Al Anderson. Sandy.
Yeah. Yep.
Crazy.
Yeah. Good stuff. So you come to town. What were some of the crucial teachable moments for you when you first came to town? How was this town for you as you were just kind of acclimating yourself from Houston?
Well, most of the things I've learned about this business, I learned kind of in a negative way. And I'm more familiar with the things I've learned in the last few weeks than the ones I learned at the beginning, because you never stop learning in this town, as you know. But, you know, I was charged with trying to get songs recorded, and we had a stable of writers, and I just had to learn the ins and outs of how to, who to get songs to, how to get a demo done, all those things. I just ask questions. You ask one person a question, they'll introduce you to somebody else. It's pretty fascinating sometimes that, you know, this Music Row area is like a college campus in some respects. I look back, and I moved here 26 years ago, and there are people that I still work with and that I see on a fairly regular basis that I work on records with and that I met 26 years ago when I moved here. I didn't realize that was happening at the time.
Right,
so
the connections you were making.
I always tell people to give young people advice when you meet somebody. When you're young and you meet somebody, just have patience with the entire process, because there's a good chance that you're going to be looking out your window 20 years from now, and that person's going to be walking down the street still. They're not going anywhere. It's not, you know, like another city where you're dealing with people. We are dealing with people all over the world, but most of what we're dealing with, they're right here, and they're all right in front of our face, and they're not going anywhere.
So be nice.
Well, be nice and learn to be pretty accepting of people. That's kind of what I try to do.
Interesting.
And hope that they're accepting of me.
Yeah. I read once that you said that you felt that Nashville is a talent-driven town versus a marketing-driven town. Do you think that's still the case these days? And I mean,
well,
how much does,
I mean,
do marketing concerns affect song
That's
choices?
A good question. I do feel like that the obviously marketing and is a huge part of selling country music right now. And it always has been. It may be more sophisticated now than ever and may be stronger than ever. But I also will tell you that this has become the musician and the songwriter capital of the world. And if you're a guitar player in Omaha and you decide you want to push, you know, you want to pursue playing guitar. Mm-hmm. First of all, 30 years ago, your dad would have told you to get over that and go get a real job.
Right, right.
And but I feel like, you know, parents are a lot cooler now, so they're saying, hey, my kid's going to get in the music business. So there's a lot of people more willing to take a swing at it now. And this is the place to move. I would think if you're in a band, there's some opportunities in other cities, New York, LA, where, you know, but if you're a musician or a songwriter, where are you going to go but here? So I still feel like that what makes Nashville special is that it is the talent capital of the world, you know, or the of America. Let's say that.
Okay.
The United States.
Yeah.
What about, at what point did you feel like you were getting a handle on being able to recognize the difference between a good song and a great song? And why is that so important? Because I know a lot of people, when they first come to town, they have good songs and they're kind of discouraged because maybe people aren't jumping all over them like they do in Omaha.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I ever learned that, and I think we all have sort of an opinion on what a great song, and that's what makes, you know, it special, our business special, is you have different opinions and that sit in seats like mine.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that I've always thought is that you just can't teach heart, and I feel like craft is the last thing I'm interested in. I just feel if I can hear heart on in a song or in songwriting, I feel like craft can be learned.
Right.
And it's hard to me to do it the other way around.
Can you expand a little bit on what you mean by heart? I mean,
well, it's probably not the best word, but it's the only word that came to mind. I sort of just mean, like, you know, the heart and soul of a poet and a musician and somebody that has a unique way of talking about music and a unique way of hearing notes, writing notes, phrasing. Their own vernacular, their own, dialect, they're probably, maybe what they've read growing up, what they study, where they're from. I just like to hear all of that in a great songwriter. And I feel like when I can hear those things, that sooner or later, that the pieces, the other components can line up.
Yeah.
It's hard to have somebody come in here that can just craft out a great song. And it's easier to learn craft than it is to learn those things I was talking about.
Yeah. That's interesting.
At least that's what I gravitate towards, you know?
Yeah.
Sure.
So.
All right. Well, let's take a break.
Let's do that.
This segment is brought to you by our friends at Toyota of Cool Springs.
That is true. Scott and I are both Toyota drivers.
Yep.
We actually love that dealership, which is kind of a weird thing to say about a car dealership, but I actually enjoy going there. I mean, eventually you got to get your car serviced, and that's always a pleasant experience. And
yeah,
just going there is never a tense experience like it can be at some car dealerships where they're
you get that knot in your stomach because you just know what's about to happen.
Right. You could get pounced on.
You go there and it's relaxed. They got a nice, if you're getting your car worked on, they got a nice lounge. But I usually just go sit at one of the tables and I can just kind of watch people as they're talking to salesmen. As people are coming in with their dogs and the receptionists are taking care of the dogs, but it's very, very casual. You don't see anybody knotted up there.
Yeah.
I love to watch people and I do look for that.
Yeah.
You don't get that feeling there.
That's true. No, you should talk to George. He's the owner and he'll take great care of you. You can find him on the web at toyotaofcoolsprings.com. We are going to be back with a whole lot more of Frank Liddell here on the Music Row Show.
What is left of a husband and wife?
It was a
four good kids who have a way of getting on with their lives. I'm not old, but I'm getting a whole lot older every day. It's too late to keep from going crazy. I got to get away. The reasons that I can't.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. You may recognize that song. That's a song called Angry All the Time. It was a big hit for Tim McGraw. And that's the demo that our guest Frank Liddell brought in for us to hear, so we could hear how that song started out before it got cut.
Well, that particular song, the Bruce story, is a kind of a long saga, and a good one. But that was from a record, actually, that Bruce had done. And
Bruce Robeson.
Bruce Robeson.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
He's out in Texas as well.
He lives in Austin.
Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. and he's from Bandera. So I've known Bruce 26 years, and he was somebody when I first heard, when I was actually talking about that story a minute ago about hearing Hart and a writer. That's the best example I can think of, because I heard him and I felt like some of his writing was rough around the edges, but I just felt like his phrasing, his, you know, choice of words, his melodies, I just never heard anything like it. It was still pretty simple, but also very sophisticated. So that was, Bruce was Carnival's first writer. He was looking for a deal in town, and nobody would sign him. So I just said, well, I can give you a little bit of money, and let's just go start a company. And he and I and a guy named Travis Hill started Carnival Music, and we were running around those songs. And the interesting thing about that song is that particular version right there, Faith Hill heard it on CMT, saw the video on CMT, his
really?
Video. And somehow she was thinking about recording it, and then Tim said he was going to record it, and I was told by her that they got in a little bit of an argument about it, but that Tim, even though she found the song, Tim was the first person to say, I'm going to record this, so he got to record it, and she sang on it. And it was I think it was Carnival's first number one hit.
Wow. That's amazing.
Wow. Had no idea that it was on the record. I knew it was on the record. But I was sitting in a meeting one time, and my intern barged in there, and he said, look at this, and he handed me the Rofax, and I said, I'm in a meeting, and he just kept giving it back to me. He said, look at this. I said, I mean, what do you want me to look at? And there was an ad saying that it was this brand new single, or going ad for ads immediately, and that was a good day for me, Travis, Bruce, Carnival, the future of Carnival.
That's great. You fired the intern, though, right?
No,
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
I bought him a beer.
There you go. Well, I'm going to back up just a little bit, because between Blue Water and Carnival, there was Decca,
right,
doing A&R there, right?
Right, that's correct.
And you said that shortly after you relaunched Decca here in Nashville, you kind of knew that it wasn't a good fit for you.
Well, and that's probably a little bit, that's part of the story. I think I'd come to town, and this is a lesson for maybe some people can learn. But I had come to town. I worked for Blue Water. It was a very small company. It was hard to get people on the phone, and we had to scrape and dig for a long time. We had a lot of success, but it wasn't easy. And getting hired to be the A&R guy at Decca was, you know, all of a sudden people answer the phone, and my boss, both my bosses were famous people, and I could call anywhere in the country and sound with Decca or MCA, because we were a division of MCA. I could get anybody on the phone. I got a 401k plan. I got an A&R incentive clause, all those things that I just thought, you know, this is great. I've things that I never thought I would have.
Right.
And so, but I really felt like as time went on that the major corporation wasn't the place for me, because I always just liked things a little bit different. And I was, we had some success. We had Leanne, Red Akins, Mark Chestnut, Gary Allen. We did a cool Buddy Holly record, and I produced the first record I ever produced on a guy named Chris Knight that was on.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was doing some of that, but I felt at the time that, you know, during that time that I would ultimately be back out on my own, and I'm much more comfortable in that place. Just am doing whatever I want, and
Good.
Cool. Well, you mentioned Leanne, and I don't know if we mentioned it yet on the show, but Leanne Womack is your wife. And I was reading, I was looking through the liner notes of one of her albums, same kind of different.
Right.
And I think you produced that, right?
I did not produce
it. You did
that
not
record.
Produce it. Okay. But every song was...
Oh, you know, I probably produced it. I might have produced a couple of songs
couple
on
of
it.
Tracks
okay.
on it.
You've produced so many.
No,
you lose
not.
Track.
but I'm sorry, Leanne who? Did I do something to hers?
Ringing a bell.
I'll see her after this, so we need to be nice.
Okay.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Yes, we love Leanne.
But what was interesting is that every one of the songs that got cut was written by a writer who was also an artist, and so they probably wrote it more from an artist kind of place, maybe not as much as for looking for cuts, you know, kind of place. What are the pros and cons of that kind of writing? And if you're not an artist, how do you tap into that?
Well, and I think her last record, The Way I'm Living, every song was like that. And I think most of the songs on that record were written by male artists as well.
Okay.
I think the I've always loved music that was from somebody more than I have loved music that was for everybody. And I kind of feel a little bit like Leanne's the same way. We grew up, we had different tastes in music. We have vastly different record collections. And we have had some heated debates over the years. But I could tell even when I was just her A&R guy that I could play her a song and she didn't get mixed up in, you know, things like what her fans might think or what radio might think. There was nothing going through her mind but, do I love this song? And mm-hmm. and I feel like, and she always had such a great knack for picking great songs, and the rest fell into place. But yeah. I could always tell her with that. So that's a song. You know, there's one comes to mind, a song one time, The Preacher Won't Have to Lie. I'd played her. Written by a guy named Billy Montana, you guys know Billy, and we were on a long drive one time. I'd play her like 30 songs, and I said, okay, I don't know what, you know, if this is anything you'd record, but I just love this song, and I played it for her, and she said, I want to record that one. It's really interesting how that works sometimes. You know, when
this was after you'd played her 30.
Yes, when you quit using your head, when the business works a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at that song, you know, I mean, I'm just trying to live so that when I die, the preacher won't have to lie. And when you look at Billy Montana, he probably wrote it about himself. You know, he probably mm-hmm. meant that. So that's, I think, when you see an artist who wrote a song, they're writing that song from themselves, from their perspective, and out of a place of loneliness. And I've always gravitated towards that, and I feel like she has too. So it's just kind of added up over the years.
Well, I appreciate that kind of thinking too from an artist, because, you know, a lot of times you just mentioned artists, I can't record that. That makes the singer look bad or something. And I mean, I can think of one song of Leanne's, the Think of a Reason Later, where, you know, the protagonist in that song isn't necessarily, you know, in the best light, you know, but it's a funny song and it works.
Well, and another example of from Leanne, I May Hate Myself in the Morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there was a time, you know, that was an era when a lot of women were singing strong women songs about, like, I'm not going to put up with this, or,
right.
you know, and that song basically says, you know, I'm vulnerable, and I'm going to get, you know, kicked around like a soccer ball. And I feel like that when she said it, it somehow, she showed a weakness, but it, you know, a vulnerability that somehow made her look even stronger. And I think that people can relate to the truth. And I think she's always had a knack for things like that, just gravitating towards things that speak to her.
I think that there are a lot of artists that are, and I shouldn't even say the artists, but maybe the people around them that are so focused on the brand that sometimes the truth is not interesting. You know, a song that's truthful isn't interesting because that doesn't fit the narrative of who this artist is. So that's to have an artist like Leanne. And speaking of artists, I remember watching, I guess it was the CMAs or the ACMs, when Miranda came out and did Kerosene, and I'd known of her, But she came out, and it was the one where all of a sudden the flames shot all up right. all around it. And I'm watching this, and I got goosebumps, and my eyes teared up. I said, oh, my God, I'm watching someone become a superstar right in front of my eyes, you know, as far as the consciousness in the country, you know. It was such a cool little thing. And you've produced so many artists.
Well,
and
you know, that was an interesting day for our family because I was not there. I was watching on the couch. That was in New York. I was watching mm-hmm. on the couch at our house with our kids. But Leanne won Album of the Year that year, and maybe Female Vocalist, or I can't remember. I think she won. She had a good night as well.
Right.
And then, of course, I had produced Miranda, and she had a good night. And right in the middle of when Miranda was up there singing, they cut to Leanne. Leanne was standing on her chair dancing.
Yeah.
So, wow.
Anyway. It's good night at our house.
Well, I'm curious because you've produced so many artists and some hit and some don't catch hold. Do you ever have a feel beforehand that something is extra good, or are there common traits in those artists that are really that hit?
Well, you know, I have no idea, actually. I get bored a little bit. I feel like there's so many people in this town that can just make great mainstream records, and I don't mean mainstream negatively. I think there's just a bunch of wonderful records all over the radio, and there always have been. But that's not necessarily what I'll ever do. So if I find an artist, if some of them work, you know, financially, great. But that's not I want them all to work financially, but that's not my motivating factor to work ever with any of them, you know. And I'm also kind of a little bit willing to go down a little bit of a different road, and I've always thought I just don't want to. If I need to get thrown out of this business, the sooner the better.
Okay.
Well, I think Miranda's a good example of that, because those, actually all of her albums have had such a different feel than anything else out yeah. there at the time.
Well, and she's really good. You just really can't phase her. And it's interesting that when we made her first record, first of all, try to talk her out of hiring me 100 times. And she just said, no, we're making a record together. And I'm grateful for that. I'm always a little bit perplexed at it. But the very first record, I thought, okay, you want to work with me? And I went and got what I thought was an interesting band, and I got Jay Joyce just because he was awesome and wild and out there, and every time he played anything, man, I just have no idea what he was doing, and I was always cracking up, and he had this great soul as well, you know. And then I had him on one side, and then had Randy Scruggs, and who I'd never worked with Randy before that record. I thought, well, this guy's Randy Scruggs. How cool is this? And
right.
got Richard Bennett, Chad Cromwell, Jim Hoke, and my friend Glenn Worf, who is one of my dearest friends in the world. And we could probably end the show right now if I just tell you the secret to making a good record is to have Glenn Worf in the room.
There you go. Did you write that down?
He's pretty amazing.
And then Mike Ruckey, and so it was all of us, and we just hauled up and just went after it. And the labels had Mark Wright and John Grady at the time just let us do it, and somehow it worked. It worked, you know.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you about that, because most times when a singing contestant comes out with music, it's usually pretty middle of the road and safe. A lot of times, and definitely Miranda's was anything but that. It was pretty hard charging,
and that's just not her. You know, that TV show was great. It actually helped all of us. You know, but going down that road was really not who she was.
I see.
But you know, because she lost, she didn't have a single. She had recorded a single, and had she won, her career would have been completely different.
Really.
Maybe she'd have been way bigger than she is now. I don't know. But anyway, she had a little time to take a step back and go start writing and figure out where she was going to sign, where she's going to work. And she's the one person I've seen from a show like that. She got over a year to go develop some. And during that year is when she wrote a couple of unbelievable songs, including a song that's still probably my favorite song she's ever written, a song called Love Is Looking For You on the first record. Mm-hmm. She wrote it by herself. So, typically you know, since it didn't segue right into the tour and the album coming out and the single, that she had time to think about what she wanted to do and why she had gotten there.
What were the powers that be? Was there any pushback about the tone that the album did take in terms of how aggressive it was?
No, you know, these guys are all friends of mine, and Mark Wright was my old boss and you know, at Decca, and he was A&R guy. And so I think, you know, he was scratching his head, you know, probably looking at me like, you know, once again, you got to do it the hard way. But I also feel like that at this place, this point in time in all of our careers, they thought, well, this is what she wants. This is what he wants. Let's just see what happens.
Hmm.
And I remember when Columbia or her label got folded into Sony, somebody had come, you know, from the other building had come and asked Mark what was going on with the next Miranda record. And he said he didn't know. And the guy was like, you don't know what your artist's doing? He said, leave them alone. Maybe they'll lay the golden egg. And I've always been appreciative of that. You know, I think some artists just need some really hands-on attention. Some just need some space. And so for the most part, my experience with her on those early records, you know, I think there are times when they're probably a little miffed, but they went with it and were supportive top to bottom.
That's great.
I'm sure they're happy now. They did.
Yeah, absolutely. They look like geniuses. So, hey, let's take a break. We're going to be back with more of Frank Liddell. You're listening to The Music Row Show. Stick around.
Well, I ought to be working in a coal mine, neck deep in black lung soot, swinging a pick at that mountainside, halfway to China. I think I would fit right in where the sun don't shine. She's better off alone. Yeah, I ought to be working in a coal mine. Lord knows I'm good at digging holes.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. Molly Jean, if you're listening, we put that on for just for you.
Yes, we did.
That's Brent Cobb doing a song called Digging Holes.
Off his new album.
Brand new album.
Which is what again?
Shine On Rainy Day.
Shine On Rainy Day.
By Dave Cobb.
There you go. We're here with Frank Liddell, producer, publisher.
Snappy dresser.
Snappy dresser.
All of the above.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see.
Good.
Yeah. No, I was going to ask you this. I was trying to figure out how to word this. I was reading an interview earlier today that your wife had given some years ago, and she was talking about how it never failed. It seemed like that whenever she put out a new album, either the label would shut down or people would get let go that she had been working with or something like that. And what is it about the music business in general that makes for such a revolving door in so many companies?
It's fascinating, I guess, that you know, when a label changes, I mean, everybody wants their opinion and wants to start new and wants to kind of get on their particular plan and get it rolling. And she has been the unfortunate beneficiary or whatever the malefish. What is that word?
That's a
something.
Malefish. Yeah. I like that.
Malefish. Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, of that having happened a handful of times, and you know,
but we've heard that many times that people just come and, you know, come and go all the time in the music business, and it's just amazing to me that it seems like more than any other industry, you know, whoever the guy is at the top probably won't be there in 2 years.
Man, I mean, they're shooting at you. You know,
yeah,
they for sure. And it is, it's a brutal business. It is tough, you know, it's like one day you're the hottest guy in town. The next day, nobody knows your name anymore,
man. Yeah.
There's there's a old joke that y'all might've heard, and I'm going to use my dear friend Glenn Worf's name because only because he told me this, but people say, who's Glenn Worf? Find me Glenn Worf. Find me somebody who plays like Glenn Worf. Who's Glenn Worf?
That's the arc.
That's the
arc of a
the progression.
That's funny.
Yes, oh. You know, so.
Well, you're talking about the executives and just the people in the label, but you know, so many pub deals are measured in months in a lot of these places.
Right.
But Carnival seems to be really committed to long term writer relationships. Why is that important to you and the writer?
Well, I just, I think every Carnival writer to a great degree is a singer-songwriter. So We've never signed a writer that we were in a bidding war over. You know, we've never chased a trend, and I'm not saying this is good or bad. It's just never happened.
That's just how you guys are.
So what happens is we usually get somebody, and we know that it's not going to be easy to introduce them, their songs to the world quickly, that it's going to take some patience. And provided that they work hard and write and are willing to, you know, stay the course, and we can keep getting better and improve. I just like having them around, you know. It's sad. I've lost a bunch of them, too, and it's sad for me usually. Sometimes they don't work out, but we try to. I like where we're sitting right now. You know, we've got a couple of writers who have been there for years, and it's been fun. I mean, that's sort of the difference. I mean, but you know, we are a mom and pop company. We're not a giant corporation,
right?
So we behave differently, and I always kind of said it like, if you're going to open up a boutique shop on the same parking lot as Walmart, you better have something they don't have,
right?
Yeah,
because.
Wow. Well, hey, we got to take one last break. We're going to be back with some more of Frank Liddell. Liz Rose just came in. Yeah, she brought a friend that looks a lot like Phil Barton.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. Hey, stick around. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Music Row Show.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's new artist Aubrey Sellers.
Sellers.
I'm sorry. I don't know how I heard Sellers. That's a song called Sit Here and Cry. And boy, she sounds a lot like somebody we've all heard. But in a good way. It's awesome.
That's she's my stepdaughter, and we work together in the studio. So she's the daughter of Leanne. Who I'm married to, and Jason Sellers, who they're both two of the best singers in the city. So if she couldn't sing,
that would be a travesty. Yes,
to do some research.
But that sounds great. That's got a nice rocking edge to it. I like that.
Let's for all of our writer listeners out there, how can a new writer, just in your opinion, how can a new writer make a great first impression when they're having a first time meeting with the publisher, besides having a great song? But what can they do to make a great first impression? And on the flip side of that, what can they do to make sure that they never get invited back?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know about the not get invited back.
That's because you're a nice guy. I can tell.
I'm always worried about me not getting invited back, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, I just like heart and uniqueness, and those are the things that move me. I'm a little perplexed if somebody walks in my office and they've written, you know, give me a CD with five songs and there's a bunch of writers on each one. They've been demoed. I mean, that where I can't tell who's doing what. I just gravitate towards uniqueness and people that are writers that can, they don't have to, but they can write by themselves. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that move me the most. Just find somebody who has a unique voice.
Hmm. That's good. For a second there, I thought he was going to say not invited back. The best way is to say, hi, I'm Scott Southworth.
That's always worked for me. That has always worked for me.
Oh, that's funny. So I'm just curious, you know, so many songs over the years have been recorded by several artists, and it's not until one particular artist comes along and it becomes a hit, even though it's been recorded many times before. What, as a producer, what is it about an artist, or what's the magic? Why is the same great song not a hit for somebody and a hit for somebody else?
Well, I think so. And what I've seen more of, and I've seen a little bit of that, but there's a bunch of factors. What I've seen more of is a song taking a long time to get recorded. And I've had, you know, I've been a part of Angry All the Time, which you heard earlier, which was 10 years old when it was a hit for Tim and Faith. And Traveling Soldier, I think, was 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a song, Let Me Try, with The House That Built Me, was several mm-hmm. years old and it had been rewritten. I think a lot of that has to do with timing and you know, in the case of a song being recorded before and not being a hit, perhaps the record wasn't nailed, so to speak, or perhaps the timing was wrong for that artist, or perhaps, you know, it's interesting how a popular theme 1 year isn't popular in a different year, and so I just think lightning has to strike for instance with Traveling Soldier. When after it was a hit, it was the most obvious thing in the world. People were calling saying, you know, why didn't you play that song for us? And I thought, well, we have 7 songs in our catalog. We played it for you 30,000 times, you know. I don't say that out of anger. I think sometimes it's just it takes the right song, the right fit, the right person, the right artist.
That must get on. I can imagine how that might get under your skin. It's like, how come you never played me that song? It's like,
it was weird.
Yeah.
It's weird, like back in the 60s and in the early 70s, somebody would have a hit and then other people would record it.
Yeah. You don't see that anymore.
Yeah. Now, you know, if you have a song on a record that sells 3 copies, somehow they're going to find out about it and say, well, we're not recording this. It's already been recorded.
Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for being on the show with us. We've really enjoyed it. And
it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Go check out Carnival Music. Carnivalmusic.com, I believe.
I think it's .net.
.net. All right. Check that out. We've got another great hour of the show coming up. We've got mega hit songwriter and publisher Liz Rose joining us here in the next hour. So you're going to want to come back for that here on the Music Row Show.